Ridge, you are listening to the Montreal Sessions special CQT 30th Anniversary Time Capsule Edition all throughout the month of March. My name is Alex. With me is Louise. Can I get a check, check, Louise?
Check, 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 check.
You're there.
I'm not hearing the time capsule music in the background.
I am.
Oh, okay. So this
You're hearing yourself?
Not really. Perhaps I've got the wrong headphones on. I'll just wing it. So this episode, which we are on episode 3, we're going to focus on feminism on the radio. So we've got a bunch of recorded clips, and we're going to have a special guest, Anna Leventhal, who was a longtime host of Venus, our feminist collective radio show. And we're going to talk about those themes. This is all part of a 30th anniversary oral history project, which is comprised of a blog and a time capsule podcast. So some of this audio is going to be available on podcast form as well. And we've had a couple of live events. And all of it was made possible due to a grant from the Canadian Heritage Foundation. And it's an ongoing project. We're just digging into the time capsule and giving you a sample of some of the cooler stuff we have discovered, but are still looking for more stuff if you have any.
So if you, CKUT listener, have tapes at home of anything, let us know.
And check out the blog, which is CKUT Time Capsule. Just Google that and listen up. So let's hear some more music. And speaking of some heavy hitters, up next is an interview we did with Penny Pickup. People know her from Deppner Le Pickup. People know her from all sorts of incarnations, but part of that history resided at CKUT during the 90s. She did a radio show she's going to explain called Cuts, as well as another one called Thread the Needle. She also was on staff as the librarian, and she spent a lot of time hanging out in the back of Fofun interviewing 90s riot girl bands. You'll hear a little bit of cacophony in the audio quality. We tried to clean it up a bit, but the ethos of 90s riot girl comes through.
Although it's not, the interview itself is not recorded in the bathroom.
No. We decided to go upscale for that one.
No one wants to do that anymore.
Okay, I hope that's enough context.
That is enough context.
All right, I'll fire
Here
it
we
up.
Go. All right, okay. You got it.
Yeah.
Welcome back to the Montreal Sessions here on CKUT Tuesday afternoons. We're here until 5 o'clock. This is the special March edition featuring 30 years of CKUT from the time capsule, which Louise recently dug up out back. Today, we have a special guest, a veteran of CKUT's radio team, Penny. Did you have a nickname back then, or was it just Penny?
Always Penny.
Always Penny.
Always Penny. Mm. No. Great to be back.
Thanks okay. for coming. Penny was a volunteer at the station in the 90s and did a number of interviews, features, and pre-Venus, I believe, right? Pre-the Venus Feminist Music Collective, Penny did what we would now probably call feminist radio.
I think we called it that then.
Okay. There you go. Maybe you could just tell us where you grew up, why you came to Montreal, that path, or maybe...
I grew up in a little steel town in northern Ontario, and could not wait to get out.
Yeah.
You were the oddball there?
Yeah, did. Wow. The first opportunity came to Montreal when I was 18.
Do you remember why you chose Montreal over, say, Toronto?
Because everyone else who was getting out of this shitty little steel town.
What was going to Toronto?
Was going to Toronto.
Running away.
And I wanted a clean slate. Yeah. Wanted a clean slate.
Yeah.
You know, landed at McGill, started writing for the paper, for the McGill Daily. Mm. It was a bastion of radical ideas. Is where I wanted to be. Found a home there. CKUT was across the hall. Mm-hmm. We were good neighbors those days.
Yeah.
Wow. It was a lot of back and forth.
Wow. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I had no idea.
Cool.
Yeah, we were both in the basement of the student union building.
And we're going to ask Pat Dillon about moving.
Yeah.
Because the move from there to here, is, you did it.
I was the move coordinator for the music library.
Mm-hmm. I'm so not surprised to hear that.
I have a great one sheet I'll show you after. That is so funny. Of us traipsing across the field with the record library.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mind-blowing.
So do you want to give us a bit of the history of the radio show?
Sure.
Cuts?
Sure.
Was there any other radio shows you were involved with?
Mm-hmm. Okay. When I first came to the station, I started with Karen Herlin, who was the host of Cuts at the time, which was CQT's women's music programming. And I co-hosted that with her for maybe a year or two, and then took it over and ran it on my own. And left it as Cuts for about a year, and then it became Scabs.
Mm.
And stayed in that iteration.
In the bruised area.
Yes, for several years. And then I became more involved in the station and, you know, served on a few committees, worked for the station in a couple different capacities. And then I did a show called Thread the Needle for a couple years.
I remember Silver.
Mm.
You want to explain what Thread the Needle was?
Well, it was a, I was co-hosting, tag teaming with Lisa. We do alternate weeks, and it was, basically as I kind of got out of women's music and doing exclusively women's programming and feeling that the conversation was really changing around, women in music, I grew more interested in linking, having like more conceptual or lyrical links and trying to link different kinds of music with an overriding theme. So they would be theme shows, whether it was, and the themes would change every week, and I would just try and get as weird and varied as I could within the hour.
Do you remember what any of the themes were?
Of course.
All right, which was, what were the most memorable?
Or well, like just ones? To maybe give an example, if I was doing a theme, if the theme for that week was trains, you know, the music would be anything from like Cramps Trug Train to Stephen Wright Trains, recording for trains, to Smithsonian Field recordings of train whistles, to hobo music, to anything I could link under the umbrella of the experience of being in or on a train and just trying to make it as interesting a journey as I could.
I feel, I said I remembered Silver. I think you did an episode about the color silver at one point. And I feel like, this might be a false memory, about You covered people who drill holes in their heads?
Trepanation. Well, that I did do an entire episode on
so
trepanation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So
I also did one on spontaneous combustion.
Wow.
I did. Yeah, they got a little out there.
Yeah. Which is incredible. And also, I would think part of what the station was able to inspire in like, you know, there was thankfully from McGone's imprint, we began to have the freedom to sort of play with radio in a different way.
Oh, it was a great era. Yeah. You really felt like you were free to explore whatever you wanted. I really didn't feel like there were any constraints or censure on programmers, and I think it led to some really creative programming all around. It was an exciting time to be on the air.
So we're torturing you today with your past, but if you could forget that it's you and comment on it because, okay, so we've got a bunch of clips that fortunately were stored on cassette and digitized and are now in the time capsule with a lot of Riot Girl bands that you would have spoken to in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of what I was commenting, one of the common things about it is that they are, usually you're speaking to, you're in the back of the phone is a, or somewhere in Fofun, you can often hear a band sound checking or something else.
Fofun was definitely the venue that most of those bands would have played at the time.
Yeah. And that you're talking to the entire band, which is often, hilarious. Yes. So
they were on tour, they did everything together.
Yeah. And so we have Lunatics and L7 and Jail, I believe, is up there, and a couple of others. So who do you remember speaking to, and what can you...
I mean, at the time, it was interesting. When I first started doing that show, I, you know, specifically had had it in my head as a mandate for that show to move away from what seemed to be the kind of common stereotype of what women's music was or could be, which was a lot of earnest folk music mm-hmm. at the time. And while, you know, there's a lot of value in those recordings, I really wanted to, like, present what other women were doing who were maybe a little bit noisier or more deviant or, you know, doing something. At the time, the music that I was excited about, I thought was some really original, innovative music. I really loved bands like ESG and... like Paulina, you know, like everyone around who was an innovator, even the Raincoats, who were just like very freeform with their style. That was the kind of music that I was excited about. And those were the bands that I would seek out, and they were hard to come by. Often you would have to, like, you know, you would have to write them from, like, tiny record labels that you found in the classified ads of, like, Maximum Rock and Roll and get their 7-inch, mm-hmm. and then it would take weeks to come, and finally you would, but that would be the thing that you would, you know, just tracking that music down was so hard.
Mm-hmm.
It was all very, like, it was all indie, it was all mm-hmm. super low budget, you really had to work to get it,
mm-hmm.
And there wasn't a lot of it out there, so amassing it was a job in itself.
Mm-hmm. And so, who did you, other than those names, three names that I've put up, who else did you remember, do you remember speaking to?
Oh, well, you know, early days, I spoke with Annie DeFranco, I spoke with Hole, I spoke mm-hmm. with Kathleen Yearwood and Mecca Normal, and anyone who came to town, I would talk to. I would always go to their shows.
Yeah.
And interview them.
And I'm, one of the common themes that keeps I kept on hearing from these women was a very defiant and self-conscious pushback against being thought of or labeled as a foxcore and a chick band. What?
Well, that it was. It was. I remember the year that article broke. Mm. And yeah, I think.
You just cussed Thurston Moore?
I did.
I thought that's what you said.
He was responsible for it. I think it was in New Music Express that he kind of coined that term of foxcore to talk about all the foxy chicks that were making music. And, you know, overnight it kind of became its own...
ish.
Yeah. And I think it did a disservice to the music by lumping all the women musicians as into one category. They mm-hmm. were making a lot of different kinds of music.
Mm-hmm.
Everything from Yoshi from the Boredoms to straight up punk to more mm-hmm. experimental. Like, you know,
mm-hmm.
it wasn't chick music. It was a lot of different kinds of music
mm-hmm.
being made by women. And it also turned it into, like, its weird own version of an indie, like, beauty pageant, because mm-hmm. they were so foxy, mm-hmm. and there was a reason to go to the shows, because there were chicks mm-hmm. up on stage, and, yeah, I found it a little hard to take.
Yeah. The tone from them is very much, we want to be measured as the boys, you know?
As musicians,
as
for
musicians.
Sure, which I could enter.
Get it, occupied! Go in the sink!
Okay. Questions? Especially since we've had this onslaught hype machine going on, and we've been talking to many interviews. Well, that was something that started like 2 years ago. It's pretty much over now. I mean, it was a bad joke. You know, the British press really sent it rolling because the British press is so desperate for angles.
It was like a bad joke, and then the press took it, the British press and other press, and other people in the press were very unimaginative, choose to use that as a label and as a category, which is totally...
Well, it sort of like leaves out the entire fact that there's like a feminine perspective on music that doesn't necessarily have to be like an anti-male kind of thing, but the women are doing stuff together and the, you know, maybe you could like...
sounds between them. You're not all one sound. I mean, there's so many women's bands and they don't sound anything alike. But also
and there's many guy in. Bands and they don't sound anything alike.
Right, yeah, but the guys they don't get lumped into like punkcore or whatever, you know?
Right, which shows, well, that's just still
cockcore.
Kind of, yeah, the kind of lack of imagination of the media, yeah. I think, was what it comes down to. It's
yeah.
Kind of like, you know, women's bands are still like a big thing for a lot of people, but they've been around for ages.
Right.
However,
I mean,
there is still something special about a women's band.
It's a
know?
Very, it's a very unique thing.
Yeah.
And, It can't be denied. So what we always
I am woman.
In all these interviews we always try to not talk about, you know, that kind of stuff. And I was talking to this guy and he was writing for a paper in Florida and he was telling me that, you know, we should at least talk about it and like state our opinions on it, even though I disagree with him a little bit, but he said it's like rock and roll was built on rebellion. And right now in rock, the ultimate rebellion is to be a woman playing rock.
Right.
And I would normally never say anything like that unless like your program seems more appropriate for it.
And then, but also trying to discuss feminism, which is that it's not insignificant that the band is all women, you know.
Sadly, that's still the case with women musicians.
Yeah, I was going to ask that. Because I also asked you to listen to a little bit of the Lydia Lunch stuff and you just said Lydia Lunch never got what she deserved.
She was underrated, I think, yeah. As an open footnote to Lydia Lunch, dear Lydia, we have all fond memories of those teenage Jesus days, but of course we couldn't expect you to stand in one spot and yell orphans in the storm forever. Perhaps it's the people around you, the inevitable hangers-on. Lydia, please take a long, hard look at what's happened. It's never too late. We know you don't really want to be a public joke, so act now. But wait, Lunch's scrutinies doesn't stop there. She also legitimizes the boys' outdated position as male spectator by bestowing on them the luxury of using political rhetoric to uphold the corrector pro-sex position. Defending her on political grounds, the boys relish the opportunity to sustain the tired positions of voyeur and female sex object, allowing them to have their lunch and eat it too. Well, I would say that that's an accurate criticism of a lot of stuff that's going on, i.e., you know, Lydia making films that are supposedly dealing with domestic violence in which she says that she is raped or asks Henry Rollins to rape her, which he does, although I don't really think that's rape when you ask someone to do it and they do it, but nevertheless, she plays with a lot of very nebulous images. But I do think that she has come a long way since then, and that I give her quite a bit of credit for where she seems to be moving these days. She talks about what she still holds from that time, being a punk rocker in New York and San Francisco in 77, and the kind of community that existed, and the ideas that she still hangs on to. She says, first and foremost, I still hold on to no compromise. As soon as I started writing, doing a band, recording records, going to Europe and touring, all that made me realize, as I had always known, you want to do something, you do it. Listen to no one but yourself. Do it. I think that's the most important lesson. Being able to take something at such an early age intensified me in the idea, don't take no for an answer. The manifestations of these themes have changed.
Having gone from one pain, one heartache, one broken bone, one mood swing, one emotional dystopia, one stab in the dark to another, well, that's just part of the developmental procedure of examining yourself and trying to get over your personal story, then looking at the greater picture. Because you're over your personal problems, you're so self-obsessed, so wounded animal in the cave, that when you finally solve the wounds, admit, eliminate denial, go to confession, and get over it, when you can see the bigger picture, you realize that you are not alone. But there's even less hope for the whole picture than there was with you just crying in your bedroom with a gun in your hand, because now you're going to need two guns, one in each hand.
And I was wondering if, the rating system is through the male lens, so there is a denigration of women in some ways, I think, because there's a less of an expectation shouldn't be taken as seriously. And the other point that I kind of am hearing, I'm not saying my own opinion, but a little bit of my own reflection on it, is because there were fewer of them, it was a harsher scrutiny. Do you think that to be the case? Like, is that what you remember?
I think it took a lot for a group of women to not just get together and play together, but to tour and to constantly have to be dealing with like male bar owners and male sound dudes, and every step of the way having to really always assert yourself just to get the sound that you want and just to get the time that you want. And I think it was exhausting for them, you know? I think it was a very different process for guys. Mm-hmm. I think they were received differently. Mm-hmm. And I think you had to work a lot harder. Mm-hmm. And also just the crap they would have to deal with at shows of, you know, guys in the audience and people being belligerent or people thinking that, you know, they had the space to take up during their live performance.
There was an aggressive claim of that space that you don't see as much anymore. Or maybe you want to comment about that.
Depends on the situation, but it's, a lot of these things are still the same, as I said earlier. When I speak to women musicians now, the complaints are, you know, still that.
But I don't think men going to shows today would have the same degree of entitlement that they did in that.
I agree.
You know, like going to see a band like Babes in Toyland, you'd have guys like being like, "Hey."
Absolutely.
Yeah, for sure.
Talking about the way that they look or what they're wearing on stage, or feeling fine to just go up on the stage and grab the mic. It was ludicrous, you know. The pit was still very male dominated. It was a boys' club. And they were like reluctant to let anyone else in.
And so in terms of like your curiosity to seek these people out, how did that come about? Like, what ignited in you? Like, you came to Montreal to go to school. And then how did that passion kind of
I think it was just spending time in radical communities and, you know, being exposed to definitely a lot more, like, radical ideas and interesting individuals. I spent a lot of time in the anarchist community when I first got to Montreal. I kind of fell into it and met a whole cast of amazing weirdos there that were really inspiring. And then when I came to CKUT, I was like, I think maybe leery initially, but it became clear to me pretty early on that it was very like open space, and everyone in the music programming was like excited and energized by weird new stuff coming along. And, you know, people would put new music in my hands and say, "Oh, I heard your show last week. I think you would like this." And it was a great way to discover new stuff, and it just expanded my horizons, you know, that ability to like have other people that are also excited and engaged about the music to contribute. And whenever I could, I would have friends or other musicians come in and co-host and find out what they were
listening
to.
Who else did you work with at that time? I think I heard Ruth on the air with you at times.
Ruth did a couple shows with me. Elaine Steff, who is a guitarist, and she was a drummer for Rhythm Activism. She co-hosted the show with me for about half a year. Often when I had friends who were musicians who were just in town on tour, they would come in and I would either interview them or they would play a set. Kat, the drummer from The X, came by, and Gene Smith from Mecha Normal would come in. It was just, I would just reel in whoever I could grab.
And there's another clip that we'll play of you reading from Angry Women, which was a research magazine, which at the time was like a Bible for the underground culture. It was really, I mean, the particular issue on pranks was something that I read voraciously, and it really inspired me.
They're still around, too.
They're still around. And, but their, I guess their place, it was common. It was like something that people who are interested in these ideas could dialogue with each other about, because we all read it, you know.
Like I those that remember were... specifically that issue. It featured like Karen Finley, Diamanda Galas, and Lydia Lunch. Like, it had all these great, amazing performers in it, and they were having conversations about their work. It was great when it first came out. You know, I've never seen so many innovative performers in one place together having this conversation.
And the clip at the beginning, you are sort of like, in most of these different clips, you're battling with the environment, which is like somebody knocking at the door or like the constant disruption, but you nonetheless felt compelled to like read this kind of really thought-provoking, and obviously what you were doing was more than just playing the tunes. You wanted to actually communicate ideas.
Okay, just a little bit of difficulty in coordinating all this stuff while people are buzzing at the door. It's hard to do a radio show and be a door woman at the same time. But, continuing, she is asked to start things off. Do you ever think it will be possible to have a society without exploitation? And Lydia responds, no, absolutely not, because I think it's man's nature to exploit power, position, authority, money, and it stems basically from greed. Exploitation and greed are tied together, and seeing as the history of our planet has been male-dominated, completely male-dominated, and the general disrespect that human beings have come to accept, take for granted, astounds me. It doesn't seem like there's going to be any reversal of that. So exploitation, ownership, and greed prevail. At this point, when asked, she said, what would be the difference if power were transferred to a woman-dominated society? At this point, which is astounding to me, I don't see the improvement of position of women in social, political, or economic echelons. I don't see equality at all. I still see chronic domination by white middle-aged men in positions of power who will remain there forever because they decide who gets to decide. Nothing short of total war between the sexes is going to eliminate that. Equality hasn't happened, not in the past 10 years. Just imagine the progress that's been made in the past 20 or 40. I don't know when that generation will finally die out, of men who think like dinosaurs and behave like their ancestors.
So talk about that in terms of the artists that you spoke to.
I mean, yeah, it was always trying to get to the either people's source of inspiration or, like, you know, what it was that they were contributing to a larger conversation and what they had to say. And I always wanted to be able to, you know, give them room and not just have their performance be the sole version of how they would be received. I wanted to give them extra room to put it into context or talk about where it came from and why they chose the subjects they did. Yeah, I would say a lot of women would be really reluctant to identify as being part of a feminist movement or conversation. It was at that time, it was something that was a little bit of a...
There's my phone. Speaking of constant interruptions. Oh, so it was not popular at the time.
No.
How come?
No, I mean, I think it was seen as a pretty, like, negative mantle.
Oh, was it because it was classist? Was it that?
Partially. Could be. Like, that it was maybe a bit more, I think maybe feminism at that era was seen as being more rooted in either academia or a particularly, like, shrill version of political activism, which, you know, maybe they identified with less, but I would say it was always part of the punk ethos of, like, you know, taking your personal freedom, finding your own voice.
And I guess, like, Diamante Galas,
expressing it on your own terms.
Sprinkle, for sure, is, in some ways, in an academic context, in some, you would think, although what they're putting out there has this kind of radical, kind of sensational kind of allure as well, you know? Like, whom they draw in was, in spite of them being defiant against the academia, was often, like...
Co-opted, you know, by the academia? I'm sure a lot of people do their theses on Annie Sprinkle, but...
Yeah. But I think we were, at that time, like, with Negative Land or with, like, those ideas of co-option and of, you know, the revolution being televised, even in spite of its defiance not to be, was very... There was a cynicism, I guess, that was very sharp. Is that still happening?
I love how you're, like, the voice of contemporary.
Yeah, we don't know.
I'm not even a millennial. No, I am. I'm the oldest millennial. Is that still happening? I mean, I don't know. The revolution will be Spotify?
Yeah.
I'm not sure I understand. Exactly.
It's more about it, how, like...
academia?
Yeah, co-opted by either... Mostly, it is a co-opted, well, people blame, largely by academia.
I mean, a lot of things now for... Academia gets the blame for a lot of things now. You know, the whole idea of, say, gender-neutral pronouns is like something that's like, oh, it's all this from academia. You know.
Yeah, well, the concept of safe space certainly wasn't around in the 90s.
Yeah.
And what you're hearing from those women is like an army boot to the head kind of safe space. Like, that's how they're going to get it. Like, they're going to fight physically to claim the space.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think at that time there were, you know, really many venues outside of academia that were having a, like, cohesive conversation. There were definitely some really great zines, but, you know, their distribution was pretty small, pretty limited. I wouldn't say there was anyone really having a conversation on, like, a national level and getting the kind of exposure the way that some academia does.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I could see why there was some kickback to it, but... you know, and a lot of these things came out of really small movements and small towns, and they were happening within cities, and then the only way they would get exposure is if you would have to go on tour. So I think people were, you know, kind of protective of what it was they were doing, and there wasn't really a large forum. There was no internet, basically. Yeah. There was no internet.
And there wasn't as much of a DIY network in the sense that, like, now... You wouldn't necessarily have to go to Fufun to see, or Bar even, to see if an all-women punk band came through now. Fufun is probably the last, one of the last places.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and...
Yeah, you've made it. Your establishment of your playing
but
there
this,
now.
But that's... I mean, that generation of the 90s, like, forged that path. So, yeah, I can see why. I mean, Fofoon is not a safe space. Now, it was, it wasn't then, I'm sure. It was. I mean, you mentioned Fofoon to someone that was there in the 90s, and the first thing that everyone always said is they played hardcore mm-hmm. pornography on the video mm-hmm. monitors. You know, right there, that's like...
Yeah.
That's, which is a weird thing.
What kind of vibe are you creating?
Well, yeah, it's also like a trashy bar mm. thing in Quebec that's you don't see much of that anymore, but you used to see more of it.
Now we got VLT machines.
You know, remember going into bars?
Oh, New Brasseries on Pinay, and like so many bars that just have porn on all the time.
Yeah,
it's like absolutely bizarre in retrospect.
Well, bars were pickup joints, so everybody had to get horny to make them drink more. Like, it was just, that was the whole thing.
Go back to the beginning, I mean, we cut this in at the beginning, but...
But, I mean, another thing I remember about the station at that time is, like, so I went from being, a programmer, and during those days, a lot of programmers, it was pretty isolating, you know? You would kind of have your, neighboring jockey shows mm-hmm. that you would precede and follow, and I was always sandwiched between early days, the Homo Show, mm-hmm. David Shannon, mm-hmm. we lost, and then later days it was Souvenir Anonyme, mm-hmm. and then followed by Queercore, and you know, so the people that you would see when you would go in to do your show, I was always pretty tight with, but then there were other programmers mm-hmm. that you would just never ever see, because mm-hmm. your time slots never allowed for you to cross paths, mm-hmm. so you would just know them by listening to their show, mm-hmm. so you would kind of have this affinity with people, you know, who you've never met, because you'd never, outside of the regular staff, you would just never see them. Where was I going with this? It was only when I kind of got brought into the fold. I think after that I became, I got asked to sit on programming. Mm-hmm. And so I got to review a lot of shows mm-hmm. and meet a lot of programmers, and then I became music librarian. Mm-hmm. And that was a really great way to meet a lot of people who wanted to be involved with the station and interact with them and mm-hmm. give them music to listen to and kind of take on more of a mentoring. And I feel like that was always an aspect of the station that I mm-hmm. loved, even if you kind of came in off the street mm-hmm. in a very novice, raw way. Eventually, after doing so much time, you would usually wind up on the other end and wind up mentoring somebody.
Very quickly, sometimes.
Yeah, and bringing them in. And I feel like it's always sort of mm-hmm. had that very familial role in the community.
And it also imprints people in a particular way, so that you do have that thing in common, no matter if you'd never share a piece of music in your collection, you know? You still have that experience of, you know, doing radio with microphones falling down as you're trying to interview someone in that kind of chaos.
And we're back. This is the Montreal Sessions. My name is Alex. With me is Louise. This month of March, we're into the third week now, I believe. The Montreal Sessions is devoted entirely to looking through the time capsule, CQT 30th anniversary time capsule, which Louise dug up in the backyard. And we've slowly been going through it bit by bit and seeing what's in there. We just heard a long interview with former volunteer host, interviewer, intrepid journalist Penny Pickup. And now, Louise, what do we have?
We heard it also an ad for something that is currently happening, just in case your time traveling watch is going to get broken. Friday, but this is an ad for an event that Queercore, our show that's still on the air.
Mondays at 6.
Queercore followed by Dykes on Mics. When Ellen DeGeneres decided to come out.
those were the days.
But back in 97. It was a big deal. And Queercore decided to host a party. So here's the radio spot for it.
You're good.
Our little
girl is all grown up.
And she's coming out. You go, girl.
CKUT cordially requests the owner of your presence at Montreal's official coming out party, comedian Ellen DeGeneres, at Club Home, the city's hottest dance club. We'll be airing the coming out episode of Ellen live on Wednesday, April 30th on two, count them, two mega-sized screens in rave-quality supersonic surround sound. We'll also be featuring live comedy acts and CKUT's funkiest music DJs. That's Wednesday, April 30th at Club Home. The party, the CKUT funding drive benefit, starts at 7:30 p.m. Club Home, formerly Cox, is located at 1450 St. Catherine East, corner Plessis, in the gay village.
The time has come for me to break out of the shell. I have to shout.
I wonder, A, what is at the corner now?
True.
And B, how many big screen TVs does that, if it's still a bar, how many big screen TVs are in there now? There was only two back then.
And that was a big deal.
Two flatties. Actually, at the time, they were probably not flatties. Anyway.
Yeah, probably. Tubes in there. Got their tubes tied. But it just shows part of the history of CKUT to do something and to be all rallied around a character in a sitcom.
Yeah.
Fictitious sitcom.
Well, coming, I mean, out. Not a,
it was a big deal.
A real actress,
a real person. And it was a great party and a great idea. I hope there's something in the cultural zeitgeist that unifies us all together and we could have another party.
No around. Radio events around some like Game of Thrones thing.
No, not happening.
No.
Possibly, but you're not invited.
I don't want to be invited. Today, my name is Alex and this is Louise, and we have a special guest with us today. Her name is Anna Leventhal, longtime volunteer here at CKUT and was a longtime host of the Venus program. How are you doing? Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Can you hear yourself?
I hear myself fine.
Okay, great.
Yeah, it's really cool to be here. It's been a long time.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
So, should we get Little Flowers of Evil going in the background?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
This is, Anna said that this was one of their talkover tracks, so we're going to keep into the time zone thing and go back.
Yeah, totally.
It's actually 1969. This
just time. A little psychedelic music with some freaky poetry of Charles Baudelaire on top of it.
And how did that happen? How did you pick up that?
I think that Catherine found it in the library and was just like, what's this? It looks cool, which is actually how we found a lot of our music before we had regular internet access.
So Catherine was your co-host?
Catherine was one of my co-hosts. And Ange Wilson was another co-host for quite a long time. The three of us held it down for many, many years. But actually, I was thinking about it, and I think I co-hosted the show with maybe almost 30 people over the years. Or maybe I'm thinking of my roommates. I'm not sure, but... I definitely,
it's kind of the same thing.
Yeah, maybe it was more like a dozen. Anyway, there was a, I think that was one of the things that was coolest about Venus Radio for me, was that I got to meet so many amazing women. Because, Venus is kind of a feeder show, right? It's a CKUT, like it's a collective show. So when people come to the station and want to get into music, and if they're, in any way interested in feminism or feminist music or music made by women or women in the music industry, then, there's a fairly good chance that they'll end up on Venus. So, we got to train a lot of people and we got to learn about their musical tastes. So
what is the years that this is all happening? Like, what year did you come to the station?
I started in 2000, in the year 2000. And
Y2K,
yeah, exactly. We were all amazed that, in fact, the radios were still working.
Right.
The airplanes weren't falling out of the sky. We all survived that very fraught time. Mm-hmm. And I had just recently kind of decided that I was interested in radio. And I showed up at the station, and Lori Edmonds was the music coordinator. And I just kind of like walked into the office and was like, hi, I want to be on the radio. And she was, kind of understandably like, yeah, you don't just get to like come in here and be on the radio. But I sort of like, talked a little bit about why I was interested in it. And she sort of like warmed up to me a bit and told me about the process for getting on a show. And she was like, actually, there's this show called Venus. And the three women who were currently hosting it or who had been hosting it until recently were all, you know, moving away from Montreal or going away for the summer or something. So she was like, you could jump in next week if you wanted to or something like that. So I very quickly ended up doing a show much faster than I had anticipated. So that was in 2000. And yeah.
What was your music bug at the time? Like, what were you listening to? And
well,
what did you want to share?
Yeah, it's kind of just in listening to the interview with Penny and then also the things that Erin McLeod was saying earlier about wanting to push back against the sort of like Women in Song volumes 1 through 5,000 or whatever. I totally understand that. But at the same time, like, I was a little bit coming from that background. Like, Ani DiFranco has been mentioned many times already in these 2 hours, and I'm going to mention her again. I mean, I was a huge Ani fan as a teenager. By the time I started, volunteering at CKUT, I was no longer on the Ani wagon. As many of her mega fans fell off. But I definitely did come from a background of, you know, sort of like folk music. And I guess that sort of dreaded genre of women's music. And I find it kind of interesting in retrospect that we were all kind of so nervous about it and nervous as being seen as being part of that. Because, yeah, I mean, for sure, at the time, you know, I would get so mad when people would be like, oh, women's music show, I guess you play a lot of Sarah McLachlan. And I would just be like, no, we don't. But, you know, why did we fear Sarah McLachlan so much? Why did we fear being seen as, I guess just
well,
because.
Well, I'm sure Lori would have something to say about that.
What would you have to say about
Sarah
McLachlan? Well,
I think that what I'm wondering now is perhaps the question is, where did your musical tastes go as a result of being here? Because I think that, obviously we're not interested in championing top 30 or more mainstream.
Yeah. Which I think that was, if I can pipe up, Sarah McLachlan and Annie DeFranco eventually became part of the music industry writ large. And,
yeah.
You know, I think that became part of the problem.
Yeah, just, yeah.
And yeah, I think, you have to dig deeper, basically.
Yeah, and I think that is sort of more what we were pushing back against, is the idea that this just became sort of the hegemony in terms of what women in music meant, is that it meant this one thing, which was, you know, the music that you would buy in a CD at the counter at Starbucks. And, you know, we were trying to say that it was more than that, and that women have always had a presence in all sorts of genres of music, including, you know, punk and rock and whatever, like French chansons and, I don't know, new wave, whatever. I can keep naming genres, but I won't. I think that is partly what we were trying to push back against. But definitely my taste got, I discovered a lot of weird music while I was at CKUT in those formative years, and definitely my tastes broadened a lot, just partly by having access to the music library, because, you know, we didn't have Spotify, we didn't have YouTube, so I just spent a lot of time in that library in the listening room, just sort of finding out about things.
And what was going on in the local scene during the years that you were at the station, like? What was the feminist, like we were talking about Riot Girls?
I was at the station for 13 years, so a lot happened between 2000 and 2013. But like, I remember there being sort of an art punk scene that was really exciting. And, you know, that wasn't quite, I mean, I think in my first year at the station, I really didn't have a huge grasp on what was happening in Montreal. Like, I would probably go to shows at Artichaut before it was Casa, but it would have been more in sort of like the folky singer-songwriter vein. But then, like, I remember going to see Les Georges Leningrad and being like quite blown away by Dominique and just their sort of aesthetic in general. I don't know what else was happening in the scene here.
A lot.
I guess it kind of depends on like what era you want to focus on.
Those are big years. I mean, those that first decade you're talking about is you know, so much happened to you.
Mm-hmm. Lesbians on ecstasy.
Lesbians on ecstasy, for sure, yeah. And I mean, I guess that was also the decade in which the Arcade Fire emerged, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, whatever.
Played the Casa.
Yeah, 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 I know, exactly. And, you know, we were very excited about them when they first started and definitely played them on this show. Yeah, and I guess that whole sort of, like, Montreal indie rock scene that had its moment on the international stage was sort of nascent at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So that was exciting.
Do you remember artists that you spoke to or brought in to perform or any of those?
Yeah, well, I mean, Tune Yards is one, and I guess we're gonna hear that interview a little bit later. Yeah, so Catherine, who was one of the co-hosts and part of the collective, worked at the Casa del Popolo for a long time. So she had sort of this like direct access to the music scene. So she was seeing shows, you know, 4 or 5 times a week. So she definitely brought in a lot of people like, you know, like Tune Yards, just by virtue of having seen her perform and saying like, wow, you know, this person's really cool. We need to get her on the show. And yeah, who else? I don't know.
I mean, obviously, for much of our people involved at CKUT, think of the karaoke, because every every local musician got in on that. I think he roped in a lot of members of the different musical communities for that occasion.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I remember Lynn T from Lesbians in Ecstasy had a good turn on that, and Dominique's I'm Too Sexy is never to be forgotten. Lisa Gamble also did something. That was a really fun tradition that we had, the radio key.
And how was feminism defined in those days? Were people embracing the term, or was there much analysis of the music in that context?
I would say, I mean, those of us who are part of the collective definitely embraced the term feminism. And, you know, we never really felt conflicted about that. Like, we never really wondered if it was relevant. But we did sort of question, like, the definition of the show. Because, you know, it had always just been, like, it's a show about women in music. And, like, without being defined any further than that. and, you know, that doesn't necessarily just mean one thing. Like, what that means is not always obvious to anyone. So we did have discussions about, you know, what is women's music? Are we going to call it female music? Are we going to call it female? Like, it's like we used the tagline female radio for a while. And I remember somebody kind of challenging us on that and saying, like, is this too limiting? And then we talked about, like, you know, genderqueer artists. And are they people that would be... like would fit into our mandate.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think that the show has definitely shifted a lot. And I think, you know, I'm not exactly, I think like now the way that the people who are still doing the show are defining it is like a show featuring basically not men, like women, genderqueer people, non-binary people, basically anyone who doesn't fit into the sort of very narrow, like dudes mm-hmm. in music kind of thing. So it's always been sort of a very flexibly defined mandate. And I think it's kind of always been open to the host's interpretations, but it has kind of developed over the years, for sure.
And my perhaps accurate, perhaps not accurate memory of it is that I think that the city really embraced it and was looking for something like that mm-hmm. could redefine in a very kind of like not antiquated, pushing back against the singer-songwriter thing, you know, feminism and women in music, but in a very exciting and relevant way. And I think that you're almost at the heyday of that era of programming here.
Yeah, yeah. And I think like one thing that we really liked about the show is that, you know, sometimes people would say, and usually people who would never heard the show would say, well, don't you find that limited, that you can only play music by women? And it was like, no, it's the opposite. It was a lack of limitation. Like, you know, if you have a jazz show, then you're limited by genre. If you have a rock show, you're limited by genre. But like, we could play anything we wanted. And I never felt like, oh, there's like a shortage of music made by women to play on the show.
Mm-hmm. There was always different international or genres to jump around in.
Yeah,
and
totally, totally. So I always saw it as a very broad category, not a narrow one at all. And I think, you know, because of that, we would kind of jump from style to style, even within one show. And that was something that people enjoyed listening to.
And what about communication with your listeners? Like, did they call in? Did they, like, I mean, you had listeners.
Yeah, for sure.
As they were talking about, and what was your relationship with
them? Yeah, I mean, we definitely had regular callers. Hello, Distributel, are you listening? I don't know if you still have the same phone with call display, but there was somebody whose call display always said Distributel, and we just referred to him as such. Maybe he's still listening right now. Call in if you are. But yeah, we definitely had some super fans. There were some guys who worked at a cheese shop who were big music fans, and they one time gifted us some Asiago. We would often, so our show, I mean, it still is from noon to two, and so we would often be complaining about how hungry we were because it was over lunch, and we would, you know, in between songs, like, fit in a little, like, oh, I want a sandwich. And one time a courier delivered us three smoothies.
Oh, wow. That's power in the city.
I know. I felt like a celebrity. So we definitely knew that there were people out there listening. But again, it was sort of like we started having a blog in the last few years that I was on the show. And now I think that maybe there's like probably a Tumblr or something. I'm not sure. I don't think the Venus Radio WordPress is that active anymore. But before we had that, we really didn't have, there wasn't really like an aggregate point where we could kind of like get a sense of how many people were listening. But yeah, we knew they were out there for sure. We would occasionally get emails to the...
A lot of community radio is about talking into the void.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, I think Penny kind of reflects a little bit about that, and there's a certain freedom in that because you you're not constantly in a position of defending or even being performative about what you were doing in terms of radio. So what other like memories or highlights do you want to share?
I mean, I think really some of the coolest things that we got to do was interview various musicians who were passing through the city. And, you know, this is something that Aaron, I think we were the only show, or like not the only show. I think that I'm the only person who didn't interview Ani DeFranco. I don't think anyone during my time on Venus did. But yeah, we had so many great people on the show. I remember Emily Bodenberg, I think, interviewed Wanda Jackson.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Which was really cool. We had Sharon Jones, rest in power, in studio, which was amazing. We spoke to La Tigra. Ange interviewed Irma Thomas. So who else? I don't know. ESG also.
A pretty amazing list.
Yeah, and that's like only a very small part of it. I actually, in retrospect, I'm kind of amazed that some of these people were like, yeah, sure, I'll be on community radio. Why not? Like, Sharon Jones is just like, she came into the studio and spent an hour here. She answered the phone for us. It was amazing.
Yeah, I remember that too. She took her shoes off immediately.
Yeah. Oh, I forgot about that. But that. Yeah.
Probably right at home.
Yeah, good, right at
good
home.
Good memory. Yeah.
The little things.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think just having the opportunity to like, also just going to shows, you know, like we got to go to a lot of these people we interviewed at their shows. So, you know, getting to go backstage felt pretty cool. I remember we went to interview, Beth Ditto was on the show. I think that, yeah, she didn't actually come in, at least not when I was there, but we did a phone interview. She was like somewhere on the road and she called in. One of the women from the Be Good Tanyas. There's a lot.
And at this time, were these women sort of accepted as no longer kind of an unusual or exotified because they were women in artists, like what Penny and I were talking about in the 90s, was like how unusual it was. So you either would experience either hypercriticism or the opposite, like just, you know, and not low expectations in a way.
Right, right. I would say that probably never ends. Yeah. I think that I'm sure that there are women today who still are experiencing that. But I definitely didn't have the sense from talking to the people that we talked to that it was in any way a liability. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm sure that there was fetishization happening and, you know, sort of like, wow, you're pretty good for a girl, still happening. So,
trying to get the proper sound check and all the technical stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean,
and did the show talk about sexuality and the way some women choose to downplay it a lot or like fight against the male gaze and the others decide to be more overt? Like, would you have those kind of analysis in playing the music, or those kind of conversations about culture at that time? Or are you?
That's a good question. I mean, that is definitely something that would come up.
Off mic?
Yeah, maybe off mic, but also on mic too. I mean, to be honest, like, I don't know if we had that much, like, we would have our banter, but we didn't necessarily get into it that deeply, but I think it would come up more in interviews. And I remember talking to Giselle Weber, and I can't remember if this was as part of an interview or in some other context, but she was talking about, you know, the idea of, like, women being sexualized on stage and, like, how she often plays with male musicians. And she's just like, yeah, I don't know. Like, when I am performing, I like to jump around a lot and, like, you know, really, like, get into it and dance and, like, whatever. Like, my body's jigglier than a man's body and it looks like I'm trying to, like, be sexy, but it's just the way my body is, you know? So it's like this kind of, you have sexuality projected onto you no matter what you do. I hope that I'm quoting her correctly. This was a long time ago, but it was like something along those lines of just being like, mm-hmm. you know, just by virtue of the fact that that I look a certain way, I am going to be sexualized in a way that, like, a man who is, you know, performing in a similar way won't be.
Yep. Should we go to a music track and take a little break?
Sure. And okay, yep. What do you got queued up? We're listening to Shirley Scott right now, by the way, the queen of the Hammond B3.
Nice.
This is the Montreal Session, CQT 90.3 FM in Montreal.
Theme song.
And we're back. This is the Montreal Sessions. We're here till 5, off the hours, coming up with us in the studio today. Special guest, Anne Leventhal, former host, one of the many hosts of the Venus Collective, CQT's feminist music show, which airs every
one day.
Thursday from noon until 2 in its 22nd year, I calculated.
And actually, at our 25th anniversary, Nico, remember Nico?
Sure do.
Was on the board when Anne Leventhal was also on the board, which we're going to get to. Mm-hmm. But he very impassionately said that CQT is a feminist organization.
Hmm.
And he was a little drunk at the time. But I appreciated what he was saying. I think meaning that it was non-hierarchical. And
I mean, I think it definitely aims to be a
feminist organization.
I think so.
So we want to talk about idealism and go into when you were on the board and what was the issues that we were discussing.
Money. Yeah.
Everybody turned their head and spit now.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, I think that was the issue. I mean, CQT is a nonprofit organization and but also not a charitable organization. And that was something that we came up against, is not being able to get charitable status. And that means that people don't get a tax receipt when they donate. And I think that probably limits the amount of donations that the station can get. And also CKUT's funding is tied to McGill. Can I talk about this on air?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, so I remember, like, you were asking what were the big dramas when I was on the board. And I remember one of the things was trying to get rid of the opt-out option. And that was a very dramatic time.
Yeah, I think that it's the precarious security.
Yeah.
Which is not heard over the airwaves, but is definitely part of the tension that is behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
not being able to have that long-term plan because your existence is tied to many numerous relationships, which you don't have really any control over.
Yeah, for sure. And just, I mean, the fact of how often does the existence referendum have to happen?
Every 5 years.
Every 5 years. Okay. That's not too bad. I was thinking it was like every 2 years or something. Well, but still, it's kind of a terrifying prospect that you have to run a referendum every year.
This time capsule.
Yeah.
Maybe. No, I mean, honestly, we dissed it. We just did it. And then 5 years from now, understanding what radio will be and what it means to your average McGill student is a terrifying prospect.
Hopefully the next time capsule doesn't stay buried forever.
Yes, this is what we're concerned
about. Yeah, for sure. But yeah, I mean, it's like, of course, as a community station, you want to reflect the needs of your community. And you want to make sure that you're in some ways like serving the public that you know, you're here to serve. But then at the same time, like the people who are able to make the decisions about how the station gets funding are not necessarily the people who are invested in it. So that's just a very difficult position to be in.
And also, I think like all other community organizations, I always say we're not nonprofit, we're subprofit. And trying to make do with little resources and lofty idealism and ambition in a good, healthy way creates a lot of ill will because people have the assumption that someone is getting more
right
than others.
Right.
And so what other experience in terms of like being on the board would you say in terms of like just trying to have an oversight of what goes on in this building?
Yeah, I mean, definitely being on the board was an eye-opening experience for me because I didn't really know that much about, I mean, I think probably most volunteers don't know a lot about what happens behind the scenes and how very precarious the station's existence is. So that was interesting for me. And I think I'm still sort of thinking over that comment that you just said that Nico made about it being a feminist organization. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I like that idea. And like to me, I mean, you can probably talk about how true it is more than I can. But like for me, that was a big part of what made Venus a feminist show was not just playing women in music, but the fact that we were sort of collectively organized. So that was like something that kind of, to me, really distinguished it, that we made our decisions collectively. And, you know, it was always this like hilarious, like doing our scheduling, trying to schedule the shows with the various hosts was always this like big drama, not drama in a bad way, but like, you know, we would meet and like make our schedule months in advance to make sure that everyone like got their fair share of time.
So I don't know if there's a relationship between fairness and femininity, but that's interesting. One potentially there is. I mean, the other thing that is could be considered feminist, I'm not sure, but is that very much at the station, it's not about a popularity contest. It's like relationships and authenticity of that expression is more important than mass appeal.
Yeah.
And I kind of equate that to like a nurturing feminist perspective in some ways.
Yeah, and I will say, you know, I mentioned all of these, you know, amazing artists that we got to interview and have on the show, but at the same time, like some of the most meaningful interviews that we did were, you know, just like some person who we saw playing at a coffee shop with like five people there. Mm-hmm. And some of those people went on to be very big and some of them didn't. And, you know, that's fine. And I'm glad that we were able to give those people space. And I think that, you know, the show as it continues is still doing that, which is really cool.
And I think also the way we defined diversity is an ongoing and very elastic conversation as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we try to be inclusive and yet that is not, I don't know, it's trying to have as without inclusive, without, what's the word I want to use?
Being tokenistic?
But not even like just putting everybody, okay, you're labeling everything.
Right. Yeah.
And I just wanted to add that it's pretty incredible that you can walk into the station at a very young age, within in short order, be doing radio and eventually be doing be sitting on the board of governors is like a pretty amazing thing.
Yeah, that's true. It was a whirlwind.
Slightly traumatized.
And you know, if anyone else out there listening is interested in doing same, volunteering at CKUT.ca.
I have orientations the other time.
Do it.
First Thursday of the month, noon, 3 and 6 p.m. So.